Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's November 8th. And I just want to remind everybody that a week from today, we have an exam scheduled, and we're going to go over that in just a second. We will have lecture on Tuesday, but don't forget, Monday is a holiday, so campus is closed on Monday. But before we get started, we have an announcement from your SI leader. Go ahead, take it away.
Thank you. So for today, we have a secondary SI session, okay? It's in SEM 203 right after this, 1 to 3 o'clock. So it's right up there, somewhere up there. And the other thing is, I'm passing around a mock exam sign-up sheet. I will not be sending out a mock exam via email this time. So I'm having two times. So one on Tuesday at 9 to 11, and one on the afternoon from 1 to 3. So the only way you can get the mock exam this time is if you attend personally now. Okay? So I'll be passing around a sign-up sheet, so please make sure you guys sign in at the appropriate time. Okay? Because I will only make enough copies for that time. Okay? So just letting you guys know, so I'll pass it around at the end. Please, whoever's at the top, bring it back down for me. Okay? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. So let's look at the schedule on the left-hand side. And so today's the 8th. There's the cursor. And we're going to hopefully finish up muscle physiology today. All right, so the chapters that will be on the exam a week from today will be 9, 10, 11, and 12, but not 13, which is on your schedule. But that should not be news to you because I mentioned that last time. All right, since last time, I also put all the lectures online that I had, except for the autonomic nervous system. That one did not get recorded. And also, all of the online quizzes have been activated so that you can take all the online quizzes from now to the end of the semester. If there's a problem with recording a grade in Blackboard, I had a student that had a problem with a grade being recorded. I'll check that over, make sure it wasn't a programming error, but you should be good for everything. If there's a problem, just let me know by email. Okay, any questions on muscle? Oh, I see a question, yeah. No, we don't. No, we don't. I mentioned that earlier, that the 22nd is Thanksgiving, but we're not going to have a lecture on the 22nd. Okay. So that will be a holiday. Okay. We'll have to make up for that one way or another. Okay. Any other questions? No. All right. Let's. How many different kinds of muscle do we know about? Three kinds. What are three kinds of muscle? Cardiac, skeletal, and smooth muscle. And which have we been talking mostly about so far? Skeletal muscle. That's right. So I want you to make sure you know that hierarchical organization of muscle. Muscles can be broken down into fascicles, fascicles down into muscle cells. Cells can be broken down further into myofibrils, and then myofibrils are made up of myofilaments, and you should know a couple different kinds of myofilaments, namely the thick and thin, or actin and myosin filaments. And it's the interaction between actin and myosin that causes that functional unit of contraction to shorten or to contract. And so what is that structural and functional unit of contraction called? Yeah, it's called the sarcomere. So if you know how a sarcomere contracts or shortens, you know everything about at least skeletal muscle. And since cardiac muscle is striated, you also know how cardiac muscle contracts as well. It's sliding of those filaments. Not so much for smooth muscle. We'll look at smooth muscle toward the end of this chapter. All right, so we were on this illustration. Let me go to this display since we're done with the calendar of events. So we were looking at this, the cycle of cross bridge formation. We call this cross bridge cycling. So there has to be, I lost the cursor again, where did it go? Here it is, All right, so here is the actin molecule, that's the thin filament. Here is the thick filament or the myosin molecule. Myosin has a head group, right, and a tailpiece that can form a cross bridge with actin under certain conditions. And we'll have to talk about that in just a little bit. Can't talk about that just at the moment. But let's just say the conditions are met so that cross bridges can form. There can be association between the actin binding site on myosin, which is where I have the cursor right now, and a myosin binding site on the actin molecule. These two sites can match up because they have the proper shape, so there can be a nice association between actin and myosin. And there is also on the head group a active site for ATP, and there's an ATPase enzyme activity within the head group. So when ATP binds to the head group. It can hydrolyze ATP to ADP and inorganic phosphate. And when that happens, when ATP is hydrolyzed into these two smaller molecules, what's happening? What kind of reaction is that? When ATP gets broken down, is that, in terms of energetics, is that an endergonic or exergonic reaction? Exergonic reaction. So that releases a lot of energy that can be used by other kinds of processes. And what is what that energy is used for is for extending this cross bridge. All right, so instead of having a 90-degree bend, the cross bridge has more of a straight configuration or an extended configuration. And when it has a straight configuration under proper conditions, it can bind to an actin molecule, right? Not when it's in this flex condition. So when ATP is hydrolyzed, the myosin head group can bind to an actin molecule, which we see in the second part of the diagram right here. All right, so a cross bridge is formed between actin and myosin. They're glued together, and there's still ADP and inorganic phosphate bound to the myosin head group, but when inorganic phosphate leaves, diffuses away, then something special happens. Then this extended form of the cross bridge changes conformation back to this flexed condition, and when it does, it pulls the actin molecule to the right. And don't forget, the actin molecule is attached to something in the sarcomere. What's it attached to? The Z disc or the Z line. So, in effect then, when this cross bridge cycles from an extended to a flexed form, in this case, right, it's pulling on the actin, but that's really pulling on the Z disc, and it's bringing the Z discs together on both the right and left sides of the sarcomere. Okay, then after, so that's what we call the power stroke. Power stroke is controlled by the release of inorganic phosphate. And when that happens, after the power stroke, then ADP can leave the active site. Now we have an empty active site right here. And what can bind to it? ATP can bind. Right, so a nice fresh ATP binds. And when that happens, that causes the release of the myosin head group from the actin molecule. And we get back to this condition right here. All right, so now we still have an ATP. And what's trapped in this ATP? What's trapped in ATP? You could think of ATP as being a coenzyme that's carrying something from one reaction to another. And it's a big molecule. What's it carrying from one chemical reaction to another? Okay, it's not carrying an acetyl group like acetyl-CoA does or coenzyme A. It's actually carrying energy. So think of energy as actually being an entity of something. So ATP is a coenzyme that carries energy around inside the cell. And ATP can release that energy when it's hydrolyzed. When that energy is released, then this flexed form of a cross bridge can go into this extended form once again. And when it's in the extended form, under proper conditions, it can bind to an actin molecule. And then when the PI, inorganic phosphate, is released, then it goes through the power stroke and the actin molecules slide over each other, actin and myosin slide over each other once again. So this happens over and over and over again. All right, and don't forget, this is just in one simple dimension. It's just in a flat plane. But don't forget, there's actin molecules down over here. Cross bridges form below it. There are cross bridges and actin molecules to the right and to the left, so all of these things surround each other. So there are lots of cross bridges that can generate a lot of tension. All right, so let's see what are some of the proper conditions that allow for cross bridge cycling. Well, you need ATP in order for that to happen, okay? But you need some other kinds of compounds as well. So we need to analyze this actin molecule in a little bit more detail. So here I see the G-actin, the globular actin subunits joining together to form that thin filament, but there are some other important proteins involved. This long protein right here is tropomyosin, and fortunately that's a really long name. Tropomyosin under normal conditions is covering up the binding site for the myosin head group. So when tropomyosin is in the way, actin and myosin can't associate with each other. They can't bind to each other when tropomyosin is in the way. Tropomyosin not only is associated in covering up the binding sites for myosin head group, but it's also associated with another kind of protein called troponin. And it's a complex of three molecules. And this troponin molecule has the ability to bind calcium. And calcium is a big electrolyte. It's a big ion. And when calcium binds to troponin, that's like poking you in the side. What's going to happen? It's going to change conformation of troponin. And since troponin is bound to tropomyosin, that's going to change the conformation of tropomyosin. And when the conformation of tropomyosin changes, it reveals the binding sites for the myosin head group. So myosin can bind to actin when there are high levels of calcium in the myofibril. So calcium is the signaling molecule that changes conformation of all these things so that there can be an association of the myosin head group with the myosin binding site on a G protein making up an actin. And when that happens, as long as ATP is available, then you can have cross-bridge cycling like we saw on the previous slide. Okay, in relaxed muscle, tropomyosin blocks the binding sites for myosin. As a matter of fact, on this illustration right here, I can't even see the binding sites because they're being covered up by tropomyosin. And so cross-bridge formation or cycling can't occur. This happens right under micromolar concentrations of calcium. I don't think that's important to know that number, but when the concentration of calcium is very low in the cell, which it is under normal conditions, right? You learn that calcium is high outside the cell, but low inside, except in what kind of tissue? Smooth endoplasmic reticulum can act as a reservoir for calcium because it has calcium pumps. It has a calcium ATP pump that can pump calcium from low concentration in the cytosol to high concentration inside the endoplasmic reticulum. All right, so contraction can occur only when these binding sites are revealed or exposed. All right, so here's the troponin, and now I can see a binding site for myosin, but it's still covered up by tropomyosin, so this myosin head group can't bind to this active site right here because it can't get past tropomyosin. But when calcium is at a high concentration, like we see in the slide down below it, calcium binds to troponin, causes a conformation change in troponin, which causes a conformation change in tropomyosin. So it moved it from below the G-actins to up above it, and that then reveals the binding site so that myosin and actin now can bind to each other and form a cross bridge. All right, so cross bridges can form under the conditions of high calcium concentrations within the myofibril. Right, and as long as there's ATP, then you can have cross-bridge cycling like we saw on a couple of previous slides. So calcium is an important signaling compound for muscle contraction. Without calcium, of course, then skeletal muscles can't contract. So if you were to choose, where would you like to have proper levels of calcium when your body starts to run low on calcium? Would it be bones to make bones strong? Is that a good thing to have strong bones? Yeah, that's a really good thing. But if you have to choose, where would you put it? In bones to make bones strong or in muscles so that muscles can contract? Yeah, because the diaphragm is just a skeletal muscle, works just this way. You wouldn't even be able to breathe without the proper levels of calcium. Okay? And indeed, your body makes that same choice as we get older. So you should protect your calcium reserve stores when you're young, because that's when you can affect your bone density easily, is when we're young, by proper diet and exercise. Right? And so what's the diet you have to have? Calcium and vitamin D, so that you can absorb calcium from your diet. And then the second thing, which everybody hates, is exercise, right? Because when you exercise the tissue, it gets bigger and stronger. And when muscles pull on bones, those bones get bigger and stronger, and they build up calcium for later on in life. Okay, so let's look at the control of contraction. So we saw how cross bridges cycle, and that requires ATP. We saw that how it's controlled. The switch that controls cross bridge cycling is that increase in calcium within a myofibril. All right, but let's see how a nerve fiber can actually stimulate nerve muscle contraction. All right, so in order to do that, we need to have a little bit better idea of the structures inside a muscle fiber. And here's a nice muscle fiber, skeletal muscle fiber, because I see many nuclei right here. It's multinucleate, and it's just a nice straight linear structure. It's not branched. It doesn't look like a football like in smooth muscle. And I see myofibrils. Remember, that's you should consider that the organelle of contraction. And these myofibrils then show a sarcomere, this repeating pattern over and over again, which produces striations. Okay. So Skeletal muscle, when it contracts, needs a lot of ATP. That's why we see a lot of, what are these little guys? Mitochondria making ATP. Okay, under aerobic conditions, anyway. And I see some other structures. I see some smooth endoplasmic reticulum right here. Too bad I don't know what color that is, but it kind of looks gray. What is it, pink?
Green.
Green. Oh, okay. Green. Okay, so this green right here is smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And you know it's smooth because I don't see any ribosomes on it. But we don't call it smooth ER in a skeletal muscle cell. We call it the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Right, just like the plasma membrane of a skeletal muscle cell is not really the plasma membrane, we call that the sarcolemma. Okay, the sarcolemma is the plasma membrane of a skeletal muscle cell. And then in between these parts of smooth endoplasmic reticulum, there's something called a transverse tubule, because you see that it's a tube that connects the sarcolemma on one side of the cell with the sarcolemma on the other side of the cell. And so if we make a cut across this long cell, just in this dimension, what kind of cut would that be, just from anatomy terminology? Would that be a coronal cut, or a sagittal cut, or a transverse cut? Yeah, it's a nice transverse cut, right? So these are what we call transverse tubules, which is way too wordy, so most of the time we just call them T-tubules. Okay. All right, and a skeletal muscle cell is a lot like a neuron, because on the sarcolemma, there are voltage-gated channels. And since it has voltage-gated channels, guess what can propagate on the surface of a skeletal muscle cell? What can a voltage-gated channel produce? Action potential. That's right. And remember, action potentials travel without decrement, so one end of the muscle cell compared to the other will receive that same information. And the T-tubules is just an extension of the sarcolemma, and it also has voltage-gated channels. So guess where that action potential goes? Not over just the surface of the cell, but it can take a detour down to the interior of the cell, bringing that depolarization signal everywhere inside of a muscle surrounding all of these myofibrils. Okay, so we get action potentials down through these transverse tubules. That's why they are there, to distribute action potentials deep inside of a cell, which would not find its way there otherwise. All right, so I see a triad, a structure of two elements of a sarcoplasmic reticulum. Sandwiched in the middle is the T-tubule. So when that action potential races down a T-tubule, it's going to influence the activity of what we call the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, both on the right and on the left. And probably you know the ion that's at a high concentration inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum. That is calcium. So when an action potential races down a T-tubule, it causes the sarcoplasmic reticulum to release calcium within the myofibril. And then what happens? Calcium binds to troponin. Troponin undergoes a conformation change, which then causes tropomyosin to change conformation, which means then that actin and myosin can form a crossbridge. And as long as ATP is present, the crossbridges can cycle and the filaments will slide over each other. So an action potential flowing over the sarcolemma, I lost the cursor again, here it is, over the sarcolemma going down these transverse tubules is what initiates muscle contraction through that process of what we call excitation-contraction coupling. Okay, and we didn't start with excitation, but how would the skeletal muscle here be excited? What can excite skeletal muscle? Okay, when it receives a signal from a neuron, from a somatic motor neuron. Because a somatic motor neuron is going to release a signaling compound. What's a general name for that signaling compound? A neurotransmitter, right? So that somatic motor neuron is going to release a neurotransmitter. And what is the neurotransmitter in 100% of the cases for a somatic motor outflow pathway? It's going to be acetylcholine. So acetylcholine is going to diffuse through the neuromuscular junction, and it's going to bind to a cholinergic receptor, right? Because it was a cholinergic neuron, it's got to have a cholinergic receptor. How many different kinds of cholinergic receptors are you aware of? Two major kinds, and they're called nicotinic and muscarinic. What are the kind that are in the neuromuscular junction? I think I talked about this. Okay, it's a nicotinic type cholinergic receptor, which is just a simple ion channel. So when acetylcholine binds, it opens up a sodium channel. And what does that do to the membrane potential on the skeletal muscle cell? Depolarizes. And what is that? That's an excitatory event, okay, causing depolarization. Furthermore, within that neuromuscular junction, there are not just these ligand-gated channels like a cholinergic receptor, but there are also voltage-gated channels, which is different than what you understood to be how a neuron functions. So if the neuromuscular junction depolarizes, what happens? Action potential always ensues after that. So a skeletal muscle cell can never make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not, because as soon as there's an action potential in the neuromuscular junction, that action potential is transferred over the whole sarcolemma down through these T-tubules, releasing calcium, which then will cause cross-bridge cycling between actin and myosin, and the sarcomeres are going to shorten, and the muscle is going to contract as a result of that. Okay, so these terminal cisternae right here are important because that's where calcium is at its highest concentration. On the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, there is an active transport pump that is always going to be pumping calcium from the cytosol back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But if there's an action potential, then some calcium channels open up, and the calcium pumps can't keep up with the outflow of calcium, so calcium starts to build up within the myofibril. And here you can see all the nice thick and thin filaments. All right, so let's look in a little bit more detail. A couple other kinds of receptors and protein channels I want you to be aware of. All right, so here we have a nice neuromuscular junction. Action potential is going to come down, right? And in order for these vesicles that contain acetylcholine to fuse, to dock and fuse and release, there has to be an ion. What ion is necessary for controlling the transport of these vesicles and the release of neurotransmitter? Calcium has to go from outside the cell to inside the terminal button right here. So again, calcium is really important for synaptic transmission. So we're actually talking about a nice chemical synapse right here, even though it's been modified a little bit to be called the neuromuscular junction. And here we have a ligand-gated channel. This is just a nicotinic receptor. Oh, and it says so on the slide. That's nice. A nicotinic acetylcholine receptor on the muscle cell membrane. It's going to bind two acetylcholines. Predominantly, sodium is going to rush inside the cell, causing depolarization. And also, right within this neuromuscular junction, we have voltage-gated channels, right? Unlike dendrites and cell bodies on a neuron, right, the muscle cell does have voltage-gated channels. So when it starts to depolarize, and if it reaches threshold, what happens to this voltage-gated channel? It opens up, causes a massive depolarization, right, which then will stimulate voltage-gated channels across the whole cell membrane, and that action potential travels over the muscle cell, just like it does an axon, including down into a T-tubule, because I see another voltage-gated channel right here, probably nicely color-coded for you guys. Okay, so that wave of depolarization produced by action potentials moves through a transverse tubule, and it bumps into another kind of receptor, which is this one right here. Okay, I think it's this one right here. Okay, and this is what we call a DHP receptor. So it's going to change conformation, so it's regulated by voltage, and the voltage is going to change on the membrane when the action potential comes by. The DHP receptor is coupled to another kind of receptor which moves from the T-tubule all the way over and all the way through the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Right? And so this is what we call a ryanodine receptor. So a DHP receptor is mechanically coupled to this ryanodine receptor. So when there's a conformation change in the DHP that causes a conformation change in the ryanodine receptor, and this ryanodine receptor is also a calcium channel, right? So when the DHP pulls on this calcium channel, it opens it up. The calcium channel opens, and guess what happens to calcium? It rushes down its concentration gradient because it's super high inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum, low in the myofibril. Uh-oh, I have a sneeze coming on. Maybe we'll just go away. I think it went away. Good. Okay, so calcium is being released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, but there's another kind of channel as well. It's not drawn on this diagram, but it's a calcium-induced calcium release channel. So as calcium starts to flood the outside of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, it's going to bind to another kind of channel, which opens up and allows even more calcium to leave. And these calcium-induced calcium release channels are 10 times bigger than this ryanodine channel. So there's a big, massive flood of calcium everywhere through the myofibril when that happens, when an action potential comes down the transverse tubule. Okay. Yes, bless you. I know how you're feeling. Okay, so we've got a couple different kinds of receptors. You've got the voltage-gated channels in the T-tubule. You've got the DHP receptors, right? And then coupled between the sarcoplasmic reticulum and the DHP, you got the ryanodine. And there's even a third kind of channel, and that is the calcium-induced calcium release channel, which are even bigger than the ryanodine receptor here, which then causes a big flood of calcium. All right, and then as that action potential travels away, okay, then the ryanodine receptor will close and the calcium pumps will start to pump calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And as the calcium concentration decreases in the myofibril, then the calcium-induced release channels close and the pumps keep pumping calcium into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then calcium unbinds from troponin. Tropomyosin covers up the binding sites once again. Cross bridges can't form. So what happens to a muscle then when cross bridges can't form? Then it relaxes. Then the elastic properties of a muscle will cause it to go back to its normal resting length. Or maybe an antagonistic muscle on some opposite part of your body is going to contract and stretch that skeletal muscle back out. Okay? So that's just going to cause muscle relaxation and going back to its normal resting length. All right, so we see how important calcium is for synaptic transmission as well as sliding of myofilaments. And I think I talked about everything on this slide already, too. So this is excitation-contraction coupling. How does an action potential in an axon actually cause sliding of these myofilaments? All right, so you should know all those little pieces that we talked about. All right, so here is a flow diagram. It's missing some of these basic features that we talked about, but it's not a bad diagram. Right here you have a somatic motor neuron, releases acetylcholine, binds to nicotinic receptors, opens up a ligand, gated channel, sodium diffuses in, depolarizing stimulus is produced, which then triggers voltage-gated channels to open up, which then produces an action potential, which flows over the whole muscle cell because there are voltage-gated channels everywhere there, including the T-tubules. So you have an action potential through a T-tubule that's going to stimulate these DHP receptors, which is going to pull on a ryanodine receptor, which is going to open up calcium channels and even more calcium channels because there are some additional calcium-induced calcium release channels. And calcium diffuses into the myofibril and binds to troponin, thus stimulating contraction because tropomyosin then is moved out of the way of the binding sites on those G-actin molecules, so a myosin head group can bind to it. All right, the only other thing you have to remember is that in order for cross bridges to cycle, you do need ATP as well, right? You need some kind of energy source to get the cycling of the cross bridges. Okay, and I think we talked about this slide already. Muscle relaxation. Calcium from SR diffuses to troponin to initiate cross bridge cycling and contraction. Yeah. When the action potentials cease or stop, muscle relaxes because the calcium channels close and calcium is pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum and that covers up the binding sites once again. All right, so I'm sure this is an exam figure right here. This T-tubule talking about these different receptors. And so this coupling between a DHP and a ryanodine, that's just what we call a mechanical coupling, electromechanical release of calcium from the SR. Okay. Characteristics of contractions. Okay, twitch, summation, and tetanus. See if I can make sense of any of this stuff. Okay, so we're looking at a muscle fiber. Okay, so if we have just a simple cell someplace and excite it, then those sarcomeres are going to get shorter, right? Actin and myosin will slide over each other, and it's going to produce tension. And that tension production is what we call a twitch. So here is a graph of tension versus time. So it produces some tension, and then the tension decreases. All right. So here we have a stimulus, and of course, it's got to be a threshold stimulus. So we're artificially stimulating this particular muscle. All right. But if it was receiving a stimulus from the typical somatic motor neuron, right, it would always contract because it would always reach stimulus. So here we're just exciting this muscle because we increase the voltage from our stimulator up above threshold, right, and that produces a twitch. Notice that then the tension starts to decrease. What's happening to different chemicals inside the muscle as this tension is being produced? What's happening here? We have some ATP that's being used up, but what else has to be moving around inside the myofibrils in order to produce this tension? Calcium, yeah, calcium has to be released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then as calcium is pumped back into the SR, then the tension is decreased because the cross bridges can't cycle, right? But notice that we come along with a second stimulus before the first twitch dies away, right? And since this muscle is still producing some tension, what can you tell me about calcium levels? It's not at zero, right? There's still some calcium within the myofibril producing that tension. So if we come along with a second stimulus and cause the same amount of calcium to be released the second time added to what's ever left over, then this second twitch produces more tension. And this is what we call summation. Okay, so a muscle will contract in an all or none response, right, depending on the frequency of stimulation, right? If it's just one stimulus, then it's going to, the muscle will contract to this level of tension. But if some of the residual calcium is left within the myofibril, then these two twitches will summate and produce a greater tension. All right, so that's what we see happening right over here. So if a second stimulus occurs before muscle relaxes completely from the first, the second twitch will be greater. We call that summation. So contractions can vary in strength. There are graded contractions by, not in this particular case because we're just stimulating one muscle, but for instance, think of what a motor unit is. When you contract a muscle like the biceps brachii, not every motor unit gets activated depending on what you perceive to be your level of activity. If you're going to lift up something light, very few motor units will be activated, okay, producing kind of a weak contraction of the muscle. But if you're going to lift something heavy up, then you realize that just by looking at it, and more motor units are going to be activated, and so you can lift a heavier and heavier weight. We call that graded contraction because of recruitment of motor units. But an individual muscle cell will just contract to its ability. Okay. All right, so here we have another plot of tension versus time at different kinds of shocking regimens. And if we're at 5 shocks per second, the amplitude of these shocks or the intensity of the stimulus is going to be the same. And they're all at threshold or above. Okay, so we turn on the stimulus and we shock at 5 shocks per second. It causes the first twitch, and before the first twitch dies away, that causes a second twitch. Second twitch will summate to the first and will produce a little bit more tension, and the third will summate on the second, which produces a little bit more tension. So there's a gradual increase in tension that's being produced by this muscle cell, okay, when it's stimulated at 5 shocks per second. But there's some relaxation taking place. But the muscle doesn't relax completely either. That condition where a muscle does not relax is what we call tetanus, right? And since the muscle is partially relaxing right here, we call this partial tetanus or incomplete tetanus. So if there's any relaxation taking place, then it's incomplete tetanus, but if it never relaxes completely, it is still considered tetanus. So this circumstance, the first circumstance at 5 shocks per second, and even 10 shocks per second, if we were to really expand the scale right here, we could see there is some relaxation taking place between the twitches. That still would be a condition of incomplete tetanus. But if we increase the number of shocks up to 60 shocks per second, look what happens to that skeletal muscle. It has no time to relax whatsoever. Okay, and so this is what we call complete tetanus. And gee whiz, what's the frequency of how our electrical power is distributed from building to building? At 60 cycles per second. Just so happens that's a very efficient way of transferring energy through power lines, but it's also the most damaging to biological tissues. It just so happens that way. Okay, so that's sort of interesting to see that. So here is complete tetanus. And if a muscle goes into complete tetanus, right, it just turns into a solid and blood can't get into that muscle, what happens to its metabolism when blood can't get into a muscle? Because it's contracted. What happens to mitochondria? They get upset with you. They stop doing what? They stop producing ATP, right, because they need oxygen. And if blood can't get into a muscle, neither can oxygen. And so aerobic respiration or oxidative phosphorylation decreases or stops. So ATP starts to decrease, and when ATP, which is the energy source for cross-bridge cycling, goes away, what happens to the strength of that muscle? It starts to decrease, and we call that fatigue. Okay, so fatigue is due to the decrease in ATP, but as you decrease ATP, you also build up ADP, and you build up inorganic phosphate, and also the pH of the muscle changes. So all of those things contribute to fatigue, and so that would be a good real physiologic fatigue, but it's also going to produce pain, right, in an individual. So let's extrapolate from this individual muscle, a single muscle fiber, which can fatigue, to an individual who's maybe exercising in a gym. And if you're not a trained athlete, when you start to exercise, those muscles are going to produce a pain stimulus. And if you're not trained, how would you operate on a pain stimulus? Well, then you're going to stop that pain stimulus, and that produces what we call psychological fatigue. Right, so anytime a muscle becomes uncomfortable, then it fatigues just due to that psychological effect. I've got to find the cursor again. Ah, here it is. Okay, but in this particular case, it's not psychological fatigue. This is what we call physiologic fatigue due to a decrease in ATP, an increase in ADP, an increase in inorganic phosphate, and a decrease in pH. Hydrogen ion concentration increases, changes the biochemistry so that cross bridges can't form. Okay, here is something that's pretty interesting. This is going to be really important when we get to the cardiac chapter, which is next, by the way. We're going to look at a length tension relationship in muscle. The efficiency of contraction is influenced by the frequency of stimulation, which we saw in this previous slide, right? So the frequency of stimulation can produce incomplete tetanus or complete tetanus. So depending on how fast the muscle fiber is stimulated. Also, the thickness of each muscle fiber influences the amount of tension that can be produced. So for instance, let me go back a couple slides. How far back do I have to go? Right here. All right, so here we have a muscle fiber, and if we double the number of myofibrils in this muscle fiber by making the diameter twice, can you see that the strength of that muscle fiber, that individual fiber, will be stronger because there's a lot more sarcomeres shortening, because there's a lot more myofibrils. So as the diameter of a muscle cell increases, the number of myofibrils increase, and so it gets stronger. All right, so the diameter of a muscle cell is directly related to the tension that it can develop because more myofibrils are added to that cell. And then here's something that is not really obvious, and that is the initial length of a muscle fiber also determines what the tension that muscle cell can produce, just what the length is. There's an ideal resting length at which a maximal force can be generated. So we're going to plot out this force. So here is relative tension, so that's a force, okay? And over here, we're going to have the length of a muscle. And these are all normalized to a percentage. So 100% is going to be for, it's just normal resting length, where it's not stretched or contracted. And so we see as we shorten a muscle, from its normal length, look what happens to its tension. It starts to do what? Go up or down or stay the same? If it stayed the same, it would just be a flat line. But it doesn't. It does what? It actually goes down. Okay, so when A muscle is, when it starts to shorten, before it contracts, it gets weaker. Right? And then if we stretch a muscle a little bit before it contracts, look what happens. It gets a little bit stronger. But then, what can we do to a muscle to make it weak? We can also overstretch it. If we overstretch the muscle, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker as well. All right, so there's just some geometry of the sarcomere that you can use to explain this length-tension relationship. So here we have tension, and here we have length of a muscle. So it's just a way to visualize this length-tension relationship. But let's look at a molecular way. All right, so here we have a sarcomere, right? We have a Z-disc and a Z-disc. Here we have a second sarcomere, and here we have a third sarcomere, all at a different initial resting length. So under these conditions right here in the middle, this is what a normal sarcomere looks like under normal resting conditions at a 100% rest length. And we see some overlap between actin and myosin. And in order for these filaments to slide over each other, remember there has to be some overlap so that cross bridges can form. All right, so under these conditions, the sarcomere can shorten quite a bit. It can shorten by this amount over here and by this amount over here. Right? And when it shortens, it produces a lot of tension. So under these conditions, the sarcomere can produce a lot of tension. But if we start out trying to contract this muscle when it's already shortened, there's plenty of overlap between actin and myosin. Cross bridges can form. Well, what about sliding of the myofilaments? Can they slide over each other? They can't because the myosin is already butting up against the Z line right here. So even though cross bridges can form, okay, the sarcomere can't shorten anymore and produce any tension as a result of it. So what happens, we're on this what we call the ascending limb of the length tension curve. So when a sarcomere is too short, okay, it can't produce tension. What happens when a sarcomere is too long? If we were to stretch this muscle out past 120% of its normal resting length, okay, so here we're way out over here on the diagram, so that's like 180% of its resting length. What can you tell me about the overlap of actin and myosin? There is no overlap. All right, so under these conditions, even if there's calcium and ATP inside the cell, can there be any cross bridges from myosin to actin? That's right, and if there's no cross bridges that can form, then zero tension will be produced. Okay? All right, so the strength of a muscle is dependent on what its resting length is before it starts to contract. And we can see that skeletal muscles can get a little bit stronger if they're stretched out ahead of time. And we're going to compare this to another kind of muscle, which is striated. Not skeletal muscle, but there's another kind of muscle in your body that's striated. What kind of muscle is that? Cardiac muscle. And it's striated because what does it have? It's made up of sarcomeres, just like we're looking at right here, okay? And this is even a more important kind of function for heart muscle. And how would you like your heart muscle to be, weak or strong?
Strong.
Strong. And that all depends on how the heart is stretched out before it contracts. And how can you stretch a heart out? By letting it fill with blood, okay? And so if the heart fills with blood as it starts to stretch, guess what happens to the inherent properties of the heart as it starts to stretch? It's over here. It's operating on this ascending limb of the length tension curve. As it fills with blood, it gets stronger and stronger and stronger so that when it contracts, it can pump a lot of blood. But what happens when somebody has a hemorrhage and they start to lose a lot of blood? So a lot of blood doesn't go back to the heart, so the heart doesn't fill. What happens to heart contraction then? Then it gets weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker when that happens. Oh, come on, cursor. What happened to you? I thought I enabled it to work. Maybe I didn't. Oh, here. Okay. So as the heart stops filling with blood, it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. And then when it gets weaker, there's less blood being pumped. There's less blood returning to the heart. And then what happens to the heart? Gets weaker. Pumps less blood returns to the heart. What happens to the heart? Gets weaker and weaker and weaker. So that's a nasty positive feedback mechanism that takes place. Okay? And that's one of the things that we call cardiovascular shock. So we're going to look at ways to prevent that process from happening. And we're going to use this length-tension relationship and cardiac muscle to look at that. Okay, neural control of skeletal muscle. All right, so motor neuron cell bodies are in the central nervous system. How many nerves does it take to get from the central nervous system to a voluntary effector? Just one. And what's an example of a voluntary effector organ? Okay. But just more general than that. Biceps is a good specific example. Skeletal muscle. Yes, skeletal muscle. Can you think of another example of a voluntary effector organ besides skeletal muscle? And your answer should be, we don't want to spend a lot of time on this, your answer should be no, because the only voluntary effector organ you have is skeletal muscle. Right, that's the only thing you can control voluntarily. Everything else is under autonomic control. All right, so these motor neurons are in the ventral horn of the spinal cord. They leave the ventral root because the ventral root is motor, and it's a nice multipolar neuron. And then they're going to go, these are what we call the lower motor neurons because the cell body is in this ventral horn. And since it's a lower motor neuron, it leaves the ventral root, goes all the way to a skeletal muscle. And so we call that the final common pathway. That one neuron does receive other information from other neurons in your central nervous system. That activity of the lower motor neuron is influenced by sensory feedback from muscles and tendons. So you have receptors in muscles and tendons reporting back to the central nervous system what their length is, what their tension is, and that can influence the activity on these lower motor neurons by facilitating or inhibiting activity. And so those are what we call upper motor neurons. Right, the lower motor neuron is just the one going to the skeletal muscle. All right, so in order to control skeletal muscle movements, the nervous system must receive feedback signals, right, to form negative feedback loops on the length or the stretch of a muscle, and the apparatus for monitoring the stretch of a muscle is what we call a spindle apparatus or muscle spindle apparatus. And where do we find spindle apparatus? In a muscle. That's part of its name right there. Okay? All right? So I know you're busy writing stuff down. So muscle spindle apparatus is found in muscle, and it monitors the stretch or the length of that muscle. All right? But there are other kinds of sensors, all right, that measure tension, like a Golgi tendon organ. A Golgi tendon organ is what we find in tendons and in joint capsules to measure tension. All right? So these are two kinds of things that contribute to proprioception. So proprioception can measure length of a muscle and tension in a tendon or a joint capsule. And what kind of sense would that be, do you think? You think that's a special sense or a general sense? General sense or special sense? You have these muscle spindles and Golgi tendon organs everywhere in your body, every single tendon, every single muscle. So it's got to be general, right? Because that's what a general sense does. It's like a temperature receptor or pressure receptor. They're all over your body. So that's just a general sense, not a special sense like vision or hearing. So let's look at a spindle apparatus. And I see some nice striations on this cell right here. So you can kind of know, well, gee whiz, that's either cardiac muscle or skeletal muscle. But I don't see any branches, so that's got to be nice skeletal muscle. I see a lot of nuclei in the cell, so that's just a nice skeletal muscle cell that's going to produce some tension. And in between some of these skeletal muscle fibers is a muscle spindle. And we can see it inserted into the muscle right here. So it's going to be microscopic. You can't see these with your naked eye. You need a microscope to see it. And there are some other kinds of muscle cells inside the muscle spindle apparatus. So these things can shorten. A muscle spindle can shorten, but so can the skeletal muscle right here. It can shorten because that's what it's specialized to do, right? So these are what we call the extrafusal fibers on the outside of a spindle apparatus, and on the inside of the spindle apparatus are the intrafusal fibers. And they're innervated differently from each other. Alpha motor neurons go to the extrafusal fibers. So when an action potential comes down, stimulates the neuromuscular junction, what is the cell? What do these cells do? They always contract, right? Because they can't make up their mind to do anything else. So they contract and shorten. Okay, there are some other motor fibers. Oh, so here is the alpha fiber. I'm sorry, I pointed to both of these, but it's only this bottom one right here is the alpha fiber. But here is another motor fiber, but it's not going to the extrafusal fibers, it's going to the intrafusal fibers. All right, so that sends action potentials down to these intrafusal fibers, and guess what the intrafusal fibers do? They contract, right? They contract just like the extrafusal fibers do. Okay, but there are some special arrangements of special receptors inside the intrafusal fibers, okay? And then here is another fiber right here. We call this a nuclear bag fiber. I don't think I want you to know that necessarily, but there are other receptor organs within this fiber right here, the nuclear bag fiber. So these things, these receptor organs, will monitor the stretch of the spindle apparatus from end to end. All right, so this is how this thing works. So when we want to contract a muscle, action potentials go down the gamma fiber and cause the spindle apparatus to contract. And action potentials go down the alpha motor neurons, causing the skeletal muscle to contract. And those action potentials cause the spindle apparatus to go to the exact length that you perceive or is determined by your cerebellum for that muscle to contract to perform some kind of appropriate activity. All right, so the spindle apparatus makes the set point for muscle length because it's receiving information from the central nervous system. So the spindle apparatus goes to the perfect length of contraction. And then, okay, at that same time, action potentials go down to the extrafusal fibers and cause them to contract. Okay, and if these muscles, if the intrafusal fibers and extrafusal fibers contract to the same length, to the same degree, then the extrafusal fibers don't produce any error in contraction. They have actually contracted to the set point that has been produced by the spindle apparatus. And these receptors in the spindle apparatus don't send any error messages back to the central nervous system. Right? But if the skeletal muscles don't contract to the same degree as the spindle apparatus, then the contraction in the extrafusal fibers will be different than the intrafusal, right? And so they don't match up to the set point. And so there is an error in muscle contraction, and these receptors right here will send action potentials back to the brain saying that the extrafusal fibers are at a different length than the intrafusal fibers, and then the cerebellum and the spinal cord can make changes in how it sends action potentials to the extrafusal fibers so that the intrafusal and extrafusal fibers match up to what? The exact same length. And that happens very, very rapidly. So we call that when the gamma motor fibers and the alpha motor fibers get stimulated, or when the alpha motor fibers get stimulated, so do the gamma fibers. We call that coactivation. So the skeletal muscle fibers inside the spindle apparatus and the extrafusal fibers are coactivated. But if there's a difference in contraction between them that produces an error signal that's monitored by the spindle apparatus, that error signal then is sent back to the central nervous system, which then initiates a response loop, right? Because that's a stimulus. If there's an error in the length of the spindle apparatus, then that produces a stimulus to control muscle contraction. Alpha motor neurons, gamma motor neurons. I think I talked about everything that I wanted to talk about on this slide. Okay, so I think the important concept is that the spindle apparatus right here sets or maintains the length at its particular set point that's been determined by the central nervous system. And I talked about all this. The gamma and alpha are co-activated. So let's see what happens if something goes awry. All right, so here we have the quadriceps muscle, a nice spindle apparatus. Okay, and let's just say that we told this quadriceps right here to relax, so it's at just a normal resting length. And because of coactivation, the spindle apparatus is relaxed. It's at a nice normal length and normal tension, as well as the rest of the extrafusal fibers in this muscle. Okay, and along somebody comes with a hammer and plays a joke on the rectus femoris right here, and somebody taps the patellar ligament with this hammer, which pulls on the patella, okay, and the patella then pulls on the tendon of the quadriceps, which then pulls on the quadriceps, and what does it do to the quadriceps?
It
It stretches the quadriceps. But before the hammer hit, okay, what could you tell me about this spindle apparatus? It was at the proper length, and it was at the exact same length as these extrafusal fibers. So there was no error in between what the actual length of this muscle was compared to the spindle apparatus. All right, so the length of the extrafusal fiber was at exactly the set point that was set by the spindle apparatus. But if we come along and then all of a sudden stretch this muscle, okay, then it gets really long, and it's no longer at the same length as the spindle apparatus. So now there's an error between the length of the extrafusal fiber and the length of the intrafusal fiber that's monitored by those stretch receptors of the spindle apparatus, so it starts to send information back through the sensory neurons saying that, oh, guess what? Your muscle's not at the set point. It's changing, and we had nothing to do with it. Right? And the way that this muscle protects itself and protects these joints and protects the rest of the body, when it starts to stretch, right? It's so the central nervous system says, oh, this muscle is stretching, but it really should be at a shorter length. Guess what it's going to do? It's going to make a decision to send impulses down through the alpha motor neurons to the extrafusal fibers to get them to contract to get back to the set point length of the spindle apparatus. And this is what we call the knee-jerk reflex or a stretch reflex. And it's a monosynaptic reflex because there's only one synapse between the sensory neuron and this alpha motor neuron going to the skeletal muscle. So it's a spindle apparatus that can measure, that has the set point control within it and can monitor the stretch of this muscle so that the muscle is at the proper length all the time. Okay, but now, if we were to tell this quadriceps to contract, right, then there's going to be extension at the knee, and if we were to tap the patellar ligament when the knee is already extended, then this muscle is contracted. So the spindle apparatus, because of coactivation, will be contracted, and there won't be any error signal. That won't produce a knee-jerk reflex. Okay, it's only when this muscle is relaxed. That's a monosynaptic reflex for protecting a muscle from overstretching. Here's a different kind of reflex, a Golgi tendon organ reflex. And we said Golgi tendons are found in the tendons of muscles to bones, and they measure tension. And unlike the stretch reflex, okay, it's going to cause this muscle to relax. The stretch reflex causes a muscle to contract, but the Golgi tendon organ reflex will cause this muscle to relax. And this is a disynaptic reflex. So here we have a muscle that's being contracted. And let's just say that it's lifting up a refrigerator. So here's a muscle lifting up a refrigerator. Okay, but what can you tell me about your biceps brachii? And even if you're using both arms, could you lift up a refrigerator? Probably not. So you have help, right? You have a friend. So you and a friend are lifting up this refrigerator, okay, because there's now two of you or three of you or four of you lifting up this really heavy object, and then all of a sudden something happens to your friend, they trip and they let go of the refrigerator. Now who's holding up the refrigerator? Just you, okay? And of course, that's really bad because now you got all that weight. What's going to happen? These muscles are going to stay contracted, but it might pull these tendons off of bones and produce a lot of damage, right? So what happens is we have these Golgi tendon organs now that see this big spike in tension being produced, and they know automatically to protect your musculoskeletal system. So these Golgi tendon organs get very excited, send a lot of action potentials to the spinal cord, which then synapse on an interneuron, and you can see that this is an excitatory synapse that causes action potentials on the interneuron, and you know this is a nice association or interneuron because it's completely within the central nervous system. Okay, but this interneuron right here releases inhibitory neurotransmitter on this alpha motor neuron, which then causes it to stop sending action potentials to the muscle. All right, so the interneuron inhibits this lower motor neuron. So here's the lower motor neuron that becomes inhibited. So what happens to the skeletal muscle when the alpha motor neuron is inhibited? It relaxes, okay, and then you drop the refrigerator as well before you rip your body apart. Okay, so the Golgi tendon organ reflex is there to protect joints and tendons from overproducing too much tension, right? But the knee-jerk reflex is here to cause a muscle to remain at some fixed length, some set point length. So they're essentially different. So they're different in their architecture. There's no interneuron for the monosynaptic reflex, but there is an interneuron for what we call a disynaptic reflex, which causes inhibition of a muscle. One causes contraction of a muscle, the other causes inhibition. It causes inhibition because of this inhibitory motor neuron right here. So it prevents excessive motor contraction or even passive muscle stretching. Let's look at a couple different kinds of muscle, cardiac and smooth. All right, in cardiac muscle, we see that it's striated, and so it has actin and myosin myofilaments in the exact same arrangement as in skeletal muscle. It's arranged in sarcomeres. So when those filaments slide over each other, the Z discs get pulled together and the sarcomere shortens. And every sarcomere from one end of the muscle cell to the other shortens, so the whole muscle cell shortens. The big difference in cardiac muscle, at least in this chapter, we're going to look at some other differences in the next chapter too, is that a cardiac muscle is relatively short. It's not long and linear. So here is the endpoint of one cell, and it goes over to here, so it's very, very short. And here's the beginning of the next myocardial cell. So this cell is going to contract, and it's going to have and this cell over here is going to contract. There's going to be a tendency for these cells to pull each other apart from each other. And of course, if that were to happen, then you'd have a hole in your heart, and you'd have blood squirting out, and that can't happen, right? So these cells are glued together by special adherence junctions, right? And this is what makes up what we call an intercalated disc, so that these cell membranes are glued together nice and tight. But there's also something else. There's something called a gap junction, and I think we looked at gap junctions before, and basically it's a sodium channel that's open all the time. So that if we stimulate one muscle cell, let's stimulate the top muscle cell, cardiac muscle cell on the right, we cause a depolarization by letting sodium enter the cell, right? That's a way that we understand depolarization. So now we have high sodium in the cell on the right, and what about sodium concentration on the cell on the left? What is sodium concentration inside of a cell? Low. So it's low here, and it's high on the right, and we have gap junctions, so sodium's going to flow through these gap junctions into the cell on the left, and when that happens, what happens to the electrical properties of the cell on the left? Yeah, this excitation causes depolarization, right, which is an excitatory event, and then through excitation-contraction coupling, this cell is going to contract as well, right, because of release of calcium. All right. So these gap junctions are necessary to make sure that the heart contracts as a unit. All right, but not only that, here I see a branch, and I see another branch. So if we excite one cell in the heart, not only does it get excited from right to left, but it also gets excited from top to bottom. We call that through the transmural wall thickness. The whole thickness of the wall contracts because these cells are branched. And without that branching, these electrical signals couldn't go from a superficial to a deeper region within inside the heart. All right, so if my two hands come together to make a heart, and it pumps, the heart has got to pump as a unit, like this, okay, in order to pump. You can't have just one side of the heart pumping and the other side not pumping. It's got to pump as a unit. So these gap junctions make sure that if one heart cell contracts, guess what they all do? They all contract as a unit, and when the heart contracts as a unit, it pumps blood. That's under normal situations. So would that be a good thing for skeletal muscle? To have gap junctions, so that if you stimulated one skeletal muscle fiber, every skeletal muscle fiber in that muscle or your body would contract. You know what? That would be terrible, because if I were to reach out for a glass of water and excite a muscle, what would happen? All the skeletal muscles in your body would contract. You could never get anything done. Okay? But the heart has a different purpose. It has to contract as a unit, so it has these gap junctions, and these gap junctions are a synapse. What kind of synapse? It's what? It's a structural and functional unit of communication between cells. But what kind of synapse is it? It's not a chemical synapse like a neuromuscular junction. It's what we call an electrical synapse, because when that sodium moves from one cell to another, that's an electrical current, because sodium is an electrolyte. So electrical properties can flow from one cell to another, or excitation can flow from one cardiac muscle cell to another through intercalated discs. And the component within an intercalated disc is a gap junction. Okay, and just like skeletal muscle, there are voltage-gated channels. over the whole plasma membrane of a cardiac muscle cell. So a cardiac muscle cell kind of acts like an axon because it has voltage-gated channels, which means what? That what can flow over the cell membrane of a cardiac muscle cell? An action potential. And remember, action potentials don't die away, so from one end to the other, an action potential is maintained with the same amplitude. So an action potential comes down, opens up these voltage-gated sodium channels, and here's a transverse tubule in a cardiac muscle cell, so that action potential moves down through a transverse tubule, just like in skeletal muscle. And here are some voltage-gated calcium channels. And when this membrane depolarizes, they open up, and calcium then is going to move or have an ability to move across the membrane. Which way is it going to move? Where is calcium normally at a high concentration? Outside the cell, it rushes in, and when it rushes in, it can bind to troponin, and then that moves tropomyosin out of the way so that cross bridges can cycle on actin and myosin within the heart, and then the heart can contract because these filaments slide over each other. Okay, there's something else that happens. When calcium enters the myocardium, the myocyte, it then causes these calcium-induced calcium release channels to open up in sarcoplasmic reticulum, and even more calcium can enter the myocardial cell, causing a stronger contraction. All right, so in skeletal muscle, we saw that the calcium that causes sliding of myofilaments comes from where in skeletal muscle? The sarcoplasmic reticulum. In cardiac muscle, the calcium comes from two sources. It comes from sarcoplasmic reticulum and also the extracellular concentration as well. All right, and this controls what we call the inotropy of the heart or the force of contraction. And so that's a lot of times where we have to monitor patients' calcium levels, because without proper calcium levels, then their heart will get weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. It won't contract, right? Because the extracellular calcium has to be at the proper levels. So again, what would be more important for you, to have proper levels of calcium in bones so that they're nice and strong, or proper calcium levels in heart so that your heart will beat and pump blood? Yeah, again, your body makes that same decision as well. So you got to protect your bones while you're young. So we have sarcomeres. There's no ryanodine receptor in heart. Calcium comes from two different sources in the heart in order for it to contract, and then the heart relaxes because of this calcium ATPase pump. Right, same thing for skeletal muscle. So there are some similarities, but some differences. In smooth muscle, okay, I don't see any sarcomere. So here's a nice electron micrograph of a smooth muscle. And a smooth muscle is not branched, but it's not long and linear either. It kind of looks like a football that's been stretched out from end to end. It's got two pointy ends. It does have actin and myosin filaments. Okay, so I see some myosin filaments in the middle right here and actin filaments over here, but they're not arranged in this repeating unit. It forms a network, like a net or a mesh, and because it forms a network or a mesh, smooth muscle is not striated, doesn't have that striated appearance. All right, and I think that's where I have to leave it for today. So on Tuesday, after your holiday, we'll come back, and then I'll remember to bring my model in for smooth muscle, and see how a smooth muscle contracts. It still has actin and myosin, and look at all the myosin head groups it has, but it's going to contract in a little bit different way. Okay, so I got to finish up a couple slides next time. And then that will be it for the exam. Yeah. You have to adjust the rate of the heart. Yeah, if their heart can't speed up, they need a pacemaker to speed the heart up when it starts to slow down too much. And when the heart slows down, they lose blood pressure and might get a little dizzy or something. So the pacemaker will take over, make the heart contract faster, maintain your blood pressure so that you can stand up and be like a normal person. Yeah, yeah, without fainting. Yeah, which is important. It's really nice to have low blood pressure, but if it's so low that you faint, that's not good. Yeah. Then that's no good.